Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush, when he was president, said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognize that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment. It's not measured in jobs, 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 and that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business and sales. It's not in public business, and it isn't in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that we cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract. And to collect those benefits in real substance. Things like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. In real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on our CD Home School for Adults, our business school. While you're at it, make sure that you order our free general law CD package at the same time. It's free of charge. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto our archives page and download it directly right there in the privacy of your own home, and I don't even have to send it to you in a plain brown envelope. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or if you want, you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it? All right, last time we were talking about destruction. We were breaking a window. Do you remember that? A kid comes along, he throws a brick through the window of the baker. And the baker now has to spend $250 with the glazer to come out and replace that window. Now, the baker was intending to use that $250 to buy a suit. Now, here's what happens in that transaction. Because he had to replace the window instead of buying the suit, he will have to do without the suit. Instead of having a window and $250 to buy the suit with, the baker now has the window. And he doesn't have his $250 and he doesn't have his suit. Or, as he was planning to buy the suit that very afternoon, instead of having both a window and the suit, he must be content with the window and no suit. Now, if we think of him as a part of our community, the community now has lost a new suit that might otherwise have come into being and is just that much poorer. The glazer's gain of business, in short, is merely a transfer of wealth from the tailor's loss. The tailor lost the business for $250. No new employment has been added. The people in the crowd were thinking only of the two parties to the transaction, that is, the baker and the glazer. They never thought about the potential third party involved, the tailor. They forgot him precisely because he's never going to enter the scene. He's never seen by anybody. They're going to see the new window, but they're never going to see that new suit. And it's precisely because that new suit is never going to be made. That new creation, that new wealth, is never created. They only see what is immediately visible to the eye. And this is why, in economics, politicians and bankers have the edge. Because, you see, with the Barack Obama jobs program, Congress will go out and they'll create a new bill. They'll fund it with more debt. And they will hire a bunch of people to dig holes and a bunch more to fill them up. And you're going to see that employment. And then, when those people that are digging the holes get their paychecks, they're going to go down to the Walmart store and they're going to spend their paychecks, and there's going to be changes in the employment picture. Instead of employment or unemployment being at 9.7%, see, it'll be at 9.6%. And the government will say, see, our jobs program really works. Well, it'll work as long as you taxpayers out there fund it, as long as you want to pay people to dig holes and dig and pay people to fill them back up again. This make work kind of CCC or WPA programs that were popularized back in the 30s. Sure, it'll work. That's great. Now, remember we were talking about Robinson Crusoe yesterday. We brought up Robinson Crusoe. Remember, he was on a ship, and it ran aground on an island. Everybody's killed but him. He swims ashore. The next day, he looks out, and there's the ship on the reef. And so he says to himself, well, gee, there's a lot of stuff out there on that ship. There's a lot of real wealth out there. So he swims out to the ship at the risk and peril of drowning or being eaten by a shark, builds a raft, and he rafts in everything he can. I mean, he tears that ship apart. He saves the boards and the lumber. He brings in barrels of gunpowder and guns, so that now he's got guns and gunpowder. He stashes this in his cave. He's salvaging this real wealth out there, the real goods. Now, let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, Robinson Crusoe is unemployed, and he wants to provide himself with full employment. Now, let's suppose that he brought in 50 barrels of gunpowder off of the ship and stuck them in his cave. And in order for him to be productively employed, he says to himself, I'm on this island. When I was back in England, I was productively employed. And now here I am, sitting around doing nothing, and I need to be employed. So he takes the 50 barrels of gunpowder, he picks them up, and he hauls them all down to the beach, stacks them all up in neat rows. Then the next day, he takes the 50 barrels of gunpowder, at great expenditure of sweat, toil, tears, and trouble, and hauls them all back on his back, carries them all back up the hill to his cave, and sticks them all back inside. Now, he does this every day. He carries the 50 barrels of gunpowder down to the beach. Let's say it's a half a mile. Then the next day, he goes down, he picks up the same 50 barrels, and he brings them all back up. He's working 18 hours a day. He's sweating his heart out. I mean, this guy is just working and working and working and toiling and toiling and toiling, and he is producing, isn't he? I mean, this guy, he's working full employment. Well, let me ask you this. How much is this improving his standard of living? Is he any better off? Now, there are three things that the modern economist is looking at here in order to bring upon prosperity, and they believe this as an article of faith. They believe that destruction brings prosperity, that make work brings prosperity, and that debt brings prosperity. What we want is more debt, more work, and more destruction, because that's the way to get rich. That's the way to bring prosperity to the nation. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're doing it today right in front of your eyeballs. They're borrowing money as fast as they can to bury you in as much debt as possible to bring about all this wonderful utopian prosperity. And they're making work. They're hiring people in the government and putting them in offices. And these people are writing things on pieces of paper, and they're buying computers and office furniture, and they're just making these people work their hearts out. And they're destroying things. I mean, they're over in two war zones now, and they're just buying stuff as fast as they can and blowing it up. Buying it and blowing it up. I mean, and if they're not blowing it up, they got the Taliban over there blowing up all these Humvees and tanks and killing people. And this destruction and all of this running around and stirring up hate and discontent and stirring up dust is what brings prosperity. And they actually believe this. Well, let's just try this on Robinson Crusoe. Let's suppose now, we took a look at his make-work operation. Let's suppose that Robinson now takes a look at his gunpowder and he says, I know how to bring more prosperity. I will destroy my gunpowder. What I will do is go out here and blow up all this gunpowder. He throws it in the fire and he destroys it all. Now, does he have a need for gunpowder? Well, yeah, he could use some gunpowder to shoot the wild goats that are on the island. A little later on in the story, he's going to need the gun and the gunpowder there to shoot the cannibals on the island. He needs it for self-defense. All right, so now after he has destroyed all of his gunpowder, doesn't he need more gunpowder? Well, of course he does. And so now he has to build fires and make charcoal. He has to run out and dig for nitrate. And we'll assume that he knows how to make gunpowder, so he's out here just working his heart out. This is causing employment. I mean, the fact that he destroyed his store's 50 barrels of gunpowder means that now he has to remake the 50 barrels of gunpowder. And this keeps him fully employed for months on end, making charcoal and digging nitrate out of the ground and mixing it together. And he makes 50 barrels of gunpowder. Can you tell me how that's advanced his standard of living or done anything constructive for him? I mean, he already had 50 barrels of gunpowder before he burned it up in the fire, remember? I mean, he already had 50 barrels of gunpowder up in his cave. He didn't need to haul it down to the beach and haul it back up to the cave and haul it down to the beach and haul it back up to the cave. Wouldn't he have been better off to save his gunpowder and to save his labor hauling it down to the beach and bringing it back up again if he'd have planted a garden? And let's suppose that he did. And while he planted the garden and was busy burning up and destroying his gunpowder, the weeds choked out his garden. That's the equivalent of debt. And now at the end of the year, he has the gunpowder back. He destroyed his gunpowder. He's got it back, but his garden's been eaten up by the debt. That is, the weeds came in and destroyed his garden. Is he going to eat better? Is he going to eat gunpowder? Now listen, people that have degrees after their names are telling us that destruction brings prosperity. They point to the Marshall Plan after World War II to rebuild Europe, and they say, my God, look at all the people we put to work here, rebuilding the cities of Germany and France and England after all this destruction. And that's true, they did. It put all those people back to work. But let's suppose World War II had not occurred. And if it hadn't occurred, then we wouldn't have blown up all those buildings. And so then the economists will come to us and say, well, gee, now you'd have all this unemployment. These people wouldn't have anything to do. Because as an article of faith, they believe that work is finite, that all the work in the world that there is already there, and it has to be carefully rationed out. All the work that there is in the world is finite. They believe that. Now, the truth of the matter is there's no end to work, and there's no such thing as unemployment. Unemployment is politically contrived and created. You have to go out of your way to create unemployment. Robinson Crusoe, if he wanted to increase his standard of living, would plant a garden and tend his garden. He would take his gunpowder and go out and shoot goats and dry the meat so that he would have meat to eat with the vegetables out of his garden. Wouldn't that be more productive, and wouldn't that add more to his standard of living than carrying barrels on his back up and down the mountain to the beach and back to his cave? Wouldn't that increase his standard of living if he were to go out and build a corral, capture a horse so that he'd have some transportation? Couldn't he more productively employ his time at doing other things like growing his garden, shooting goats and drying the meat, and capturing horses for transportation, than carrying barrels of gunpowder up and down the mountain and then destroying it all in the fire so that he could have full employment? And this teaches us a part of the lesson. You see, what we're not thinking about is that employment is not the equivalent of wealth. It's the means by which we create the wealth. And the economists equate wealth with employment. And you and I both know that we're as lazy as sin, and that neither one of us want to work. That's why we spend all that time at the water cooler pinching the girls on the butt. It's because we don't want to work. What we really want to do is to stand around with a lot of leisure time and idle time so we can go to Six Flags and ride the roller coaster and eat cotton candy and have a good time doing things and watching the Super Bowl. Hell, we don't want to get out there and work and sweat. If we wanted to do that, we would have done that a long time ago. Now, sir, human beings have five basic motivators. Motivators, I call them. It's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. We're all filled with vanity. We're all jealous. We're all filled with lust. We're all greedy and fearful. And that's what motivates us to action. That's what makes us do what we do. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. That's the way the salesman sells to you what you want. The government comes to you and they say, oh my God, you better give this money to the bankers or the economy is going to fail. They're appealing to your fear. Or they say, wouldn't you like to have free medical services? You need to vote for this new health care proposal. They're appealing to your lust and greed. Hey, they have it in England, you know. And those people over in England and Europe over there, they don't pay anything for their health care. And look at you. You have to pay for this health care. And 44 million of you don't even have it. And they're appealing to your jealousy. That's the way the salesman sells you the cars. That's the way everybody is selling everything that's being sold, is by appealing to your vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Now, remember, the economists believe, as an article of faith, that debt brings prosperity, make work brings prosperity, destruction brings prosperity. The exact truth to the matter is the opposite is true. Destruction brings poverty. Make work brings poverty, and debt brings poverty. And that's what we're beginning to see now. All of the economists since the 1930s have been teaching us, and we've been practicing destruction. Back in the 30s, they were taking pigs by the hundreds of thousands and killing them and then burning the bodies and burying the residue. And they did that so that they could keep prices up. Did it for a special group of people called farmers. Now, it would have seemed to me, since we were going to use taxpayer money to buy those pigs in the first place and kill them and destroy them, wouldn't it have made more sense to kill the pigs and then give them to the charities so that they could give them to the people in their soup when they were getting their soup in the soup lines? Now, that would have made some sense, because now the people who are unemployed, standing in the soup lines getting a handout, could now have a little meat in the soup. But by destroying the pigs and burying them, the people standing in the soup lines get soup without any pig. The taxpayers get to pay for the pig. The farmers are happy because they're getting paid for pigs that they produced. The government's happy because they've got the votes of the farmers to keep them in office. We don't seem to be looking ahead to the outcome of these events, are we? Now, we have finished with the broken window. An elementary fallacy. Anybody, one would think, would be able to avoid it after a few moments of thought. But yet this broken window fallacy, under 100 disguises, is the most persistent in the history of economics. It is more rampant now than at any time in the past, and it is solemnly reaffirmed every day by great captains of industry, by chambers of commerce, by labor union leaders, by editorial writers and newspaper columnists and radio and television commentators, by learned statisticians and professors, using the most refined techniques and computers available by professors of economics in our best universities, and in their various ways they all dilate upon the advantages of destruction. Well, I don't want to get in the way of anybody's happiness and success here, but I don't believe for a minute that if I go around my house with a hammer breaking the windows out of my house, I'm going to increase my standard of living by one iota. So my conclusion is that if breaking the windows in my house is not going to add to my standard of living, can you please tell me how me coming over and breaking the windows out of your house is going to increase your standard of living? Now, some of them would disdain to say that there are net benefits in small acts of destruction. They see almost endless benefits in enormous acts of destruction. They tell us how much better off economically we all are in the war than in peace. They see miracles of production, which it requires a war to achieve. And they see a world made prosperous by an enormous accumulated or backed up demand. In Europe after World War II, they joyously counted the houses, the whole cities that had to be leveled to the ground and that then had to be replaced. In America, they counted the houses that would not be built during the war, the nylon stockings that could not be supplied, the worn-out automobiles and tires, the obsolescent radios and refrigerators, and they brought together formidable totals. It was merely our old friend the broken window fallacy. In new clothing, the grown fat beyond recognition. This time, it was supported by a whole bundle of related fallacies. It confused need with demand. The more war destroys, the more it impoverishes. The greater is the post-war need. Indubitably. But need is not demand. Effective economic demand requires not merely need, but corresponding purchasing power. The needs of India today are incomparably greater than the needs of America, but its purchasing power, and therefore the new business that it can stimulate, are incomparably smaller. But if we can get past this point, there is a chance for another fallacy, and the broken window and the broken windowites usually grab it. They think of purchasing power merely in terms of money. Now, money can be run off by the printing press. And as this is being written, in fact, printing money is the world's biggest industry, if the product is measured in monetary terms. But the more money that's being turned out this way, the more the value of any given unit of money falls. This falling value can be measured in rising prices of commodities. But as most people are so firmly in the habit of thinking of their wealth and income in terms of money, they consider themselves better off as these monetary totals rise, in spite of the fact that in terms of things they may have less and they may be able to buy less. Most of the good economic results which people at the time attributed to World War II were really owing to wartime inflation. They could have been and were produced just as well by an equivalent peacetime inflation. We'll come back to this a little later. But let's take a minute here and let's think about this for a second. Yesterday, I pointed out to you that in 1945 to 50, my granddad, who was making $1.75 an hour, could give me a dime and I'd go down and buy an ice cream cone. And it cost a dime for a double-decker chocolate ice cream cone. The other day, I got one down at TCBY, cost $2.35, about 10 times more. It's worse than that. Worse than that. In order for me to be able to maintain the same purchasing power today that my granddad had back in 1950, I'd have to be making $42 an hour. And we're not, boys and girls. See, we're only making $17.58. So we went from $1.75 to $17.50. At the same time that the ice cream went from 10 cents to $2.35. We actually lost the purchasing power of 10 ice cream cones. We're making 10 times more money, and we think that we should be 10 times better off. No, truth of the matter is, we're about 50% poorer than we were. That's why your wife is out working. That's why half the women in America are in the workforce. It takes you and your wife to maintain the same living standard that we had in 1950. It takes two of you now. And it's getting worse. Now, these economic principles that we're taking a look at here, wages, and the falling wage, that is, in real terms, in purchasing power terms, in nominal terms, your wages are going up. I don't deny it. But in real terms, your wages are going down, and they have been for the last 100 years. You just didn't realize it. Nobody ever explained it to you. And so I thought, well, let's just take a look and let's explain it. Now, the guy that explains it the best, very simple book here. I mean, any truck driver with an IQ of 85 can read this book and understand it. Now, ordinarily, when I'm watching TV and I listen to these economists or I listen to the Secretary of the Treasury or Henry Paulson, you know, or somebody, these guys, they're talking way over our heads. They're using five-syllable, double knee-jerk words that neither one of us can understand. And we don't understand these terms that they're using. And they're talking in philosophies and philosophical terms. And what you and I need is somebody that can come along and talk to us in just plain terms, like Robinson Crusoe, all by himself as a subsistence farmer on a deserted island in the South Pacific. Now we can expand that. Remember, we took a look at the next stage up would be a cottage industry with a whole family. So we got six people in a family, a little cottage industry. Well, if we had 10 families, we would have a little community. We would have a village. And if we had 10 villages, then we would have the rudiments of an economy. And if we have a nation, we have the rudiments of a civilization, and a civilization brings upon us an economy. Now, we have a division of labor in our economy. Most of us only do one thing. And we get paid in money, and we take our money down, and we expend the money to buy all these other things. And it's a hell of a neat system, and I'm not arguing that. But when it gets out of whack and gets out of balance, it becomes unfair. And then as it becomes more and more unfair, it also becomes more and more disjointed, and it finally collapses. It just disintegrates right around us. And that's what we're witnessing today, is the disintegration of the world's economy. It was a marvel to behold, you know, when it was working well. But now it's not working. And all the king's horses and all the king's men aren't going to put it back together again. So that leaves you and I then in a quandary. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do to provide ourselves with the best standard of living that we can, in spite of all of the destruction going on around us? Now, the guy that wrote the book, his name is Henry Hazlitt, and it's spelled H-A-Z-L-I-T-T, and it's called Economics in One Lesson. I just picked it up the other day down at Barnes & Noble, my boy did. It's called the 50th Anniversary Edition, 50th Anniversary Edition, Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. It's not a very big book. I mean, hell, I can read it. It's 203 pages, about 25 chapters, easy to read, you know, and straightforward, little simple explanations like the broken window story, or debt brings prosperity, make work brings prosperity, and destruction brings prosperity. And so he goes through that and explains it, layman's terms. Now, this also fits in very well with the scriptures, because in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, our Creator told us, he said, don't use unjust weights and balances. So from about 1793 or 1794 until 1754, we used paper money and unjust weights and balances, and we in the colonies, here in America, in our 13 colonies, and we went broke in the process. So we reorganized in 1754, went back to a better grade of paper, and between 1754 and 1783, we went broke again, using paper money. Now that's twice in 100 years. So at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, a guy by the name of George Mason said, we need to fix this. Kind of like our President Barack Obama says, hey, we need to fix this. So they came up with 17 words, and it says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt, inserted it into our Constitution, created a treasury in 1794, and started minting gold and silver coin. And between 1794 and 1933, this country became the wealthiest, most prosperous nation, the most powerful military, economic, and political power in the world in 100 years. That's happened 4 or 5 times in the past. It has created this thing of the free market and the use of gold and silver coin, just weights and measures, coupled with a free market economy, will produce the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. You Russians over there, do you want to be the world's preeminent power? Go to gold and silver, get rid of your paper, get rid of all of your communist ideologies, and go to the free market economy, and you will become, in 100 years or less, the world's dominant power. You people in China, you want to become the world's dominant power? That's the formula. You people in Japan, you want to do that? That's the winning ticket right there. We got that at Mount Sinai. We've used it 3 or 4 times. The British used it. They became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. The Americans used it and worked well for us. All right. Now, at various times in history, we have tested this, and every time we test it, it works like a shot. And every time we go back to paper money and stocks and bonds and all of this horse pucky that they're selling us today and have been selling us for the last 100 years, we go to the poorhouse. Now, that's been the history of it. Now, I'm not here to persuade you. I didn't come here now to get you to join some political movement, join the Tea Party, and vote Barack Obama out. I don't really care about it. It doesn't make any difference whether you got a Republican in office or a Democrat. They're going to give you paper. They're not going to give you gold and silver. But you can use gold and silver. You can go back to Leviticus 19:35 and 36. You can practice free enterprise even in a repressive society like North Korea or China or Russia. You can do that privately yourself. Get yourself and your family, like Robinson Crusoe and Swiss Family Robinson, to working for property instead of profit, using property. And get off this thing of unjust weights and balances, and you're going to see a hell of a difference. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website at georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you'll find that free general law CD package right there, and you can download it either on your CD or you can just peruse it right there on your screen. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use in this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. They may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, remember the book we're reviewing now. It's Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, H-A-Z-L-I-T-T, 50th Anniversary Edition. He goes on to say, there's a half-truth in the backup, the demand fallacy, just as there was in the broken window fallacy. The broken window did make more business for the glazier. The destruction of war did make more business for the producers of certain things. The destruction of houses and cities did make more business for the building and construction industries. But it's misdirected production. Now let's think about it for a second. Congress some time back said, what we need is a new fighter plane. And so Congress appropriates some billions of dollars and lets out a contract, and Boeing up in Seattle wins the contract. And they're going to build an airplane called the F-22 Raptor. Hell of a neat machine. Oh, God, is it neat. It's the greatest thing since sliced white bread. Now, let me ask you this. As a taxpayer, you all got to buy into the building of the F-22. And this was a marvelous machine, and it put millions of people to work all around the world. It was a great, great invention. For instance, up in Seattle, the Boeing people let out contracts to subcontractors to make parts. And those subcontractors bid, and then when they win the bid, then they need employees. So they go out and they hire machinists to work in their machine shops, and they hire skilled people in various skilled crafts to make the parts for this airplane. And it produces employment, which is part and parcel with the program. And it makes the representatives up there in Seattle really look good. And so all you people in Seattle, you're voting these guys back into office all the time. And God, isn't it just great? Now, the problem is that while this is good for the people up in Seattle, it ain't so good for the people here in Isabella, Theodosia, and Gainesville, Missouri, because, see, we don't have any payrolls back here from the F-22 Raptor. What we get to do is we get to go out and work and sweat and produce meat, milk, butter, and eggs and sell it into the economy to feed those people out there in Seattle who now have the purchasing power with the money that they've got from our tax dollars. So what it boils down to is that we here in Isabella get to send $100 bills to Washington. Washington, in turn, sends the $100 bills out to Seattle. And the people in Seattle send those $100 bills back here to Isabella to buy our wheat, meat, milk, butter, and eggs. Isn't that just special? Well, now, boys and girls, how does that increase my standard of living? First of all, I got to send $100 to Washington. Then I got to work to produce $100 worth of goods so I can put it out into the marketplace and get my $100 back from the guy in Seattle. What do you think of that? Real good for the guy in Seattle, taint so good for me. Now, this is the way this game is played. And so some years ago when I woke up to that, I said, you know, I think I'll just drop out of this game. I'm not opposed to the other people that want to participate in the program. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But I said to myself, this thing of carrying barrels of gunpowder down to the beach and then carrying them back up here so that I can be fully employed isn't exactly what I had in mind for myself. I think what I would rather do is spend my time doing something that's going to increase my standard of living. Put another way, let me ask you this. How many of you people out there, if you had the money to spend, would go out and buy a new F-22 Raptor? Because you see, all of us are, I think they're about $100 million a copy, if I remember right. It was some astronomical number attached to it. I don't think I would. I think I might go out and buy a new suit or buy a new car. You know, I could see myself driving around in a new Lexus or maybe a new Cadillac or something. But I just couldn't see myself flying around in this F-22 Raptor. But my government decided that I needed to buy one of those. And they got me and a bunch of other people over here working to produce our goods and services so that the government then could take our money and taxes and to build these airplanes. This is a misdirection of our productive capacity. What we really want is less machinists and less F-22s and more suits and more glass and more houses and more automobiles and more of those things that you and I really want to buy. In other words, put another way, if Washington hadn't taken that $1,000 away from you in taxes, or $2,000 or $5,000 last year, what would you have done with that money? Well, you say, well, I would have saved it in the bank. Well, then the bank would have had more capital to lend to somebody to go out and produce the things that you want. Or if you say, well, I would have taken a trip on the Princess Line, good, because then the waiters and the company and all the people that work on the Princess ship would have had more money in their pockets to go out and buy the things that they wanted to buy and the things that you produce. That's what a free market economy is all about. Now, our government has no shortage of money. They can print money and spend it, and every time they do that, it makes the money in circulation get cheaper and cheaper. And that's what we're faced with here is the collapse of our currency now, the last 2 cents of it. Remember, we've already lost 98 cents. That's been inflated away. Now we're down to the last 2 cents, and that's about to be suddenly stripped away from us, and we're going to be left naked with nothing. How do you like that? Well, it's the natural results of what happens when you become profligate and you squander your resources. You take your gunpowder and you burn it up in the fire and squander it. You wake up one day and you don't have any. And so now you need to go out and make some. You know, so if you're looking for work, and I accused my wife of this a few times, you know, and said, hey, I don't need any of these make work projects now. I've got plenty that needs to be done. If you're just a normal run-of-the-mill homeowner, you know, you got lots of repairs to make on your house all the time. You know, you don't need to run around with a hammer busting windows to make more work for yourself now, do you? Well, since World War II ended in Europe, there has been rapid and even spectacular economic growth, both in countries that were ravaged by war and those that were not. Some of the countries in which there was greatest destruction, such as Germany, have advanced more rapidly than the others, such as France, in which there was much less destruction. In part, this was because West Germany followed sounder economic policies, and in part it was because the desperate need to get back to normal housing and other living conditions stimulated increased efforts. But this does not mean that property destruction is an advantage to the person whose property has just been destroyed. No man burns down his own house on the theory that the need to rebuild it will stimulate his energies. So after a war, there is normally a stimulation of energies for a time. At the beginning of the famous third chapter of the History of England, Macaulay pointed out that no ordinary misfortune, no ordinary misgovernment, will do so much to make a nation wretched as the constant progress of physical knowledge and the constant effort of every man to better himself will do to make a nation prosperous. It has often been found that profuse expenditure, heavy taxation, absurd commercial restriction, corrupt tribunals, disastrous wars, seditions, persecutions, conflagrations, inundations, have not been able to destroy capital so fast as the exertions of private citizens have been able to create it. Now, no man would want to have his own property destroyed, either in war or in peace. What is harmful or disastrous to an individual must be equally harmful or disastrous to the collection of individuals that make up the whole nation. Many of the most frequent fallacies in economic reasoning come from the propensity, especially marked today, to think in terms of an abstraction, the collectivity, the nation, and to forget or ignore the individuals who make it up and give it meaning. No one could think that the destruction of war was an economic advantage who began by thinking, first of all, of the people whose property has been destroyed. Those who think that destruction of war increases total demand forget that demand and supply are merely two sides of the same coin. They are the same thing looked at from different directions. Supply creates demand because at the bottom it is demand. The supply of the thing they make is all that people have. In fact, to offer in exchange for the things that they want. So in this sense, the farmer's supply of wheat constitutes their demand for automobiles and other goods. All this is inherent in the modern division of labor and is an exchange economy. This fundamental fact, it is true, is obscured for most people, including some reputedly brilliant economists, through such complications as wage payments and the indirect form in which virtually all modern exchanges are made through the medium of money. Well, John Stuart Mill and other classical writers, though they sometimes fail to take sufficient account of these complex consequences that arise from the use of money, at least saw through the monetary veil of the underlying realities. To that extent, they were in advance of many of their present-day critics who are totally befuddled by money rather than instructed by it. Mere inflation, that is, the mere issuance of more money, and the consequence of higher wages and prices, may look like the creation of more demand, but in terms of the actual production and exchange of real things, it isn't. Now here's a little shocker for you. If we took all the money in America today and went out and spent it, just take all the money that you've got and go down to Walmart and exchange it for goods. And I'll do the same thing. And your neighbor, he does that and he does the same thing. Everybody in America does the same thing. We all believe that the goods on the shelf down at Walmart equal all of the money that we have at our disposal. That's not true. That's a fallacy. If all of us went down to Walmart and all the stores of America and bought all the stuff that's out there for sale today, all of us would get 2 cents on the dollar. That's all. That's all that's left. It's all the goods that are out there. 2%. The other 98 cents, the other 98% that you've got here in your bank account, your checking account, and so on, hasn't been produced yet. So we have demand. We have lots of money. And the government is making more demand. They're printing more money every day. And if that money is ever employed, and people start taking delivery of the goods, we're all going to be shocked at the empty shelves in the Walmart stores. You're going to live to see that. Just like you saw down there in Port-au-Prince. Those people down there, they're not short of work. See, they've got a whole city to rebuild. They've got plenty of work in front of them. They don't have enough money. They don't have enough real material. There's not enough cement. There's not enough steel. There's not enough concrete blocks or bricks to rebuild the city. And they don't have the means to produce it. Those people are behind the eight ball. Robinson Crusoe was very fortunate in that he was able to go out to the ship and bring in all of the work, all of the labor, all of the property, all of the real goods that were on the ship. He didn't have to share it with anybody. He had 50 barrels of gunpowder and 50 or 75 muskets, 4 or 5 cannons. He had all the lumber that was on the ship, the rope. He salvaged as much as he could, do you remember? So he had a start. He had a lot of wealth. The idea that he should burn it all up and destroy it, or just leave it out there to be destroyed in the surf, was preposterous to him. That's why he went out there and salvaged everything that he could to increase his wealth. That's what wealth is. We talked about this yesterday. All wealth comes out of the ground. It comes from mining, fishing, farming, and forestry. Mining, fishing, farming, and forestry are the four activities that produce all of the wealth that comes out of the ground. And if we don't have it, then there's no wealth. Now, the wealth that's sitting on the store shelves looks good. Thousands of people walk into the Walmart store, but they don't clean the store shelves off. They buy what they need, and then they go home. And the next week, they come back, and they buy what they need. And as long as they do that, everything's fine. If those people ever get spooked, they actually take all of this purchasing power that they've got in their pockets that the government has created now, and they go down to the stores, you're going to find out that there's not enough there. In fact, I just picked up a paper the other day, and they're talking about the London Metal Exchange. You see, Germany, after World War II, you know, they lost the war, remember? They lost all their gold, and the United States has been keeping their gold for them. Well, the other day, the Germans called upon us, and they said, hey, give us our gold back, and they haven't gotten an answer yet. I suspect that they haven't gotten an answer because they're not going to get their gold back. So you people in Germany, if you think that we Americans are going to give you back your gold, you've got another guess coming. Do we owe it to you? Oh, you bet. Is it yours? Sure. Do we have it? Nope. It's been looted from us, too. All that gold that went into Fort Knox after the gold holiday, the banking holiday in 1933, that all you people in America thought you had in Fort Knox, there's nothing there. It's all gone. Been leased out. Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and Morgans and the Goldman Sachs, those are the people that have got it. And where they've got it, I don't know. But we know this. You don't have it. It's gone. Now, what you have is a lot of worthless pieces of paper that are claims on that gold. And now, the gold that has been sold on paper. See, there's two markets out there. There's a gold market. And it's divided into two segments. Paper gold, that's pieces of paper that say your gold is on deposit over here at Fort Knox. And then there's the real gold. That's the gold that you have in your desk drawer or your safe in your house or buried in a hole in the ground someplace. 18% of it's physical, and we've got it. And the other 82% is a wish. It's a wish list. Now, the gold brokers have been selling gold. They've been selling gold on paper for years. Paper promises 15 years production. Now there's 2,500 tons a year being produced. And they've sold 15 years into the future. That's 2,500 times 15, which is 37,500 tons of gold have been sold, and it doesn't exist. Hasn't been dug out of the ground yet. Now what that means is some people are going to go in and say, give me my gold, and they're going to get it. And then some other people are going to come in and say, well, then give me my gold, and there isn't going to be any left. And they're going to have to wait 15 years to get paid off. You know, somebody's going to get theirs first, and somebody's going to get theirs last. Now, that's the way that deal is going to come down. Now, we can extrapolate that out to Walmart, and we can take a look at tennis shoes and big-screen TVs and automobiles and everything else, and we've got the same problem. Now let's take a quick look here at an economy. When my granddad was a young man, there was a creek called Wages Creek up in northern Mendocino County. And you could go work in that creek. This is about 1900 now, 1880, 1900s. You could go work in that creek, and you could get about a dollar a day. That's why they called it Wages Creek, because wages were a dollar a day. You could go down to Union Lumber Company, and you could work, and you'd get paid a dollar a day. Or you could go up there and you could mine gold and you'd get a dollar a day. It didn't make any difference because if you were making boards, you were working in forestry and you were making something useful, you were producing real wealth. You got paid a dollar a day. Now, there's a thing called supply and demand. supply and demand. That's what the free market is all about. When you produce too many boards, then you won't have enough buyers to buy those boards. For instance, if I've got a unit or two of lumber sitting out here in my yard, and then the lumber salesman comes along and says, gee, Mr. Gordon, would you like to buy another unit of lumber? I look at the lumber that I've got on hand, and I say, no, I don't think I do. I've got quite a bit on hand, and I think I ought to use that up first. And the reason that I need to use it up first is because lumber deteriorates over time. Insects get into it. I mean, you can't just stick a pile of boards out there and leave it for 30 years. It's not going to be there in 30 years when you come back. So we have to use it up in a reasonable amount of time. Now, if I don't have any boards out there, and he comes by and he wants to sell to me, I say, oh yeah, I need to buy those boards. And so that's what supply and demand is all about. The salesman is out trying to find people who need boards, and then sell them the boards from his mill. Now, if for some reason I was working at the mill, and the demand for boards went down, then the mill wouldn't want to make as many boards, and so they would lay off some workers, which was no big deal, because in those days most people had some land, and so they would go back home to their land, and they would produce what they need, like Robinson Crusoe or Swiss Family Robinson, off of their own land. They would have enough to take care of themselves. Food, clothing, and shelter. Or they would go up and mine on the creek, and they would get a dollar a day in wages. Then, when the supply of boards became low, and we needed more boards, and there was greater demand, then the mill would hire more people, and then they would hire and pay you a dollar and 10 cents a day. You could make more money working in the mill than you could working on Wages Creek. And as a result of that, it keeps the supply of gold, which is produced by labor, and the supply of boards, which is produced by labor, in equilibrium. When you're producing too much gold, then the price goes down. If you're producing too many boards, the price goes down. When there's a shortage of boards, the price goes up. When there's a shortage of gold, the price goes up. And it moves people back and forth from working in the mill and working in the mine. Now, that's what supply and demand in a free market is all about. And people take the money that they make and they spend it on the things that they want, not the things that the government wants them to want, but the things that those people want to buy. And so if they want to buy houses, well then, price of houses goes up when there's a shortage. If they want to buy automobiles, then the price of automobiles goes up when there's a shortage. That's the essence of this free market economy. That's the essence of the greatness of the free market system. The thing that has made America and Britain and Western Europe the envy of the world has been this free market enterprise, free market system. And up until about, 1930 or so, the people of Europe, most of the nations of Europe and the Great Britain and the United States and Canada and Australia, we used just weights and balances. We used gold and silver. We used the free market economy. And then one day we got tired of that and we said, what we want are more socialists. We want more socialism. We want more paper. We want more profits. All right, so now we got it. Now that comes at a price. It comes with a cost. There's no such thing as a free lunch, remember? And there's no such thing as something for nothing. We'll take it up right there next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal. It says our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.